Hyperion to a Saturn.
Welcome to the 11th episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid, your guide on a scene-by-scene deep dive look at Shakespeare's masterwork through the lens of not only the text, but many film, television, comics, and music adaptations. And today we finish up Act 2, Scene 1, as Ophelia runs into her father's closet with news of Hamlet. It's right on the heels of Rinaldo's departure that Ophelia runs in, if indeed Rinaldo makes an appearance at all in any given version. And she comes in with a story about Hamlet visiting her closet. Ironically, it makes Polonius fall for the same kind of misdirection he just instructed Rinaldo to use against Laertes. But why is this scene between Ophelia and Hamlet told and not shown? Seeing as the actor playing Hamlet is about to come on stage for the longest continuous appearance in all of Shakespeare, was it done for practical reasons? More likely, but just as practical, the picture painted by Shakespeare would have been considered scandalous on the Elizabethan stage, his trousers around his ankles, as it were. Or, well, there's just no dialogue in it, so Shakespeare only writes the dialogue. There's very little in terms of stage directions, and this whole scene would have been a stage direction, which would have been pretty un-Shakespeare-like. And in a scene that is already about the trustworthiness of any given point of view, we get a secondhand account, a naive spy report from Ophelia, that propels the play exactly where Hamlet means to propel it. It is this account that involves Polonius in the story, and Polonius who involves, then, the king and queen. And when I say all part of Hamlet's plan, one question directors and actors must ask themselves is whether Ophelia's account is true. It's certainly true for her, though imagine a Hamlet where Ophelia is a willing accomplice, at least until her father's death. True for her. Okay, but was Hamlet faking? Did he sacrifice Ophelia's love for his new cause? Is he using her? Or was this a heartfelt goodbye? Or both? Let's take a quick look at the text before heading into the various adaptations. The way Ophelia tells it, "As I was sewing in my closet, Lord Hamlet with his doublet all unbraced, no hat upon his head, his stockings fouled, ungartered, and down jived to his ankle, pale as his shirt, his knees knocking each other, and with a look so piteous in purport, as if he had been loosed out of hell to speak of horrors, he comes before me." Now, this is the portrait I was referring to. Hamlet is a man who very recently has been loosed out of hell, or at least from the nether realm in which the ghost exists, placing this scene very soon after Act 1. In fact, it is a reaction to Act 1's revelations. There we had Hamlet vow to erase the slate of his memory, and here his clothes and hair are undone, a physical representation of an unmade man. And Polonius asks, "Mad for thy love?" Immediately, he jumps to this conclusion. It is his first thought on the matter, and it remains the one he supports until his demise. We've already discussed how Polonius is the man who consistently gets it wrong, and here we see how. Rather than looking at all the evidence, he sticks with his first notion and keeps building upon it, even when others suggest alternatives. Why is it his first thought? Guilt about having forbidden his daughter to see Hamlet may already have been on his mind, and certainly he falls prey to what we call today confirmation bias. Ophelia goes on. She describes specific actions and uses the word thus, like in thrice his head thus waving up and down, which encourages the actress playing Ophelia to mime Hamlet's actions, in effect merging with him now that he's ironically out of her life. It's a mirror set between two lovers. Both will suffer from madness, both will have their fathers slain, and so on. This early bit of mimicry sets up that mirror. Ophelia, "He raised a sigh so piteous and profound as it did seem to shatter his bulk and end his being. That done, he lets me go." Now, these lines, more than any others, point to Hamlet making his goodbyes and, in effect, putting to rest his old life. A more ruthless Hamlet could still fake the great sigh, of course, but the audience wants to believe Ophelia here, as she has a privileged relationship with Hamlet. Polonius confirms that Ophelia did indeed cut herself off from Hamlet, and then he says, "That hath made him mad." So he comes to that conclusion a second time. and he accuses himself of wrongdoing, but at the same time justifies those actions. He meddles, but his children lack discretion, so it evens out. He must still do what he does. In fact, he'll next go to the king and queen and meddle some more. The dramatic irony of Polonius is that while other characters in Shakespeare can overhear themselves speaking, he cannot. Other characters can realize things about themselves and adapt. He learns nothing of the truths he speaks.
This must be known, which being kept close might move more grief to hide than hate to utter love.
Wrong again, Polonius. Visual media can, of course, show us what here is merely told through Ophelia's lens, with a more objective third-person point of view. We'll look at how that choice, among others, affects the various versions of the play. And we'll start with Branagh's 1996 uncut adaptation, which makes Rinaldo's exit Ophelia's entrance. She's out of breath and teary. Kate Winslet gives us an intensely emotional performance that prefigures her later madness. One thing Branagh does not do here, as director, is show us flashbacks of Hamlet's visit. He leaves it to Winslet to mime Hamlet's actions. This is a notable choice in a film that makes wide use of flashbacks to generate interest in scenes described, but impossible to stage in the theater. The scene not pictured thus continues to be something of a mystery. We only have Ophelia's highly emotional point of view and cannot know what Hamlet's true intentions were. One line did resonate with me on this viewing.
He falls to such perusal of my face as it would draw it.
It's a line that harks back to Hamlet's oath to wipe away all fond records and erase the book of his memory. Hamlet isn't drawing, he's erasing. In the unseen moment, he almost draws her back into his book. But as he's sworn to only leave his father's revenge written in there, he can't. Shakespeare chooses his words well. It's as if he would draw it, but would is not the same as actually doing it. Also note the ironic use of the word fall in the same line. He falls to such perusal. Watch Ophelia as Polonius starts responding to this story. When he mentions the ecstasy of love, she looks up, hopeful. Does Hamlet love her? She would rather it be that than some malady out of her control. Polonius then asks, "What, have you given him any hard words of late?" As if it's all her fault. It's not fair to say Polonius refuses to take responsibility, because he does in the last few lines, but rather that he can't at first see that it's his own fault. Even when he does take responsibility here, Branagh has him say the lines in an aside, not directly at the sobbing Ophelia. So she's left believing it was, in a sense, her fault, or at least that everyone else thinks it is. Ophelia crawls into her father's bed, which some will want to label as Freudian, but I don't read any incest into it. Rather, it's another mirroring of characters. This is the Hamlet film, with the Hall of Mirrors, after all. Just as Ophelia was mirroring Hamlet's gestures earlier, here she takes the place of her father's whore from the first part of the scene in his bed. This emphasizes the old man's hypocrisy and corruption. A few moments ago, he had a girl the same age in his bed, and this staging reminds us of that. At the same time, we have Ophelia in bed with her father instead of with Hamlet. She's lost one and now has only the other, who she is also destined to lose. And both men are mirrored through the scene. Both are manipulators of each other, ideally, but of Ophelia specifically. You can also draw a line between this moment and Hamlet's confrontation with his mother later. This is a play full of inappropriate bedfellows, starting with Claudius and Gertrude. Okay, tracking back, Olivier removes Polonius from this scene entirely and turns Ophelia's words into a soliloquy and a narrated flashback. Unlike most other directors, actually, he chooses to show what Ophelia is describing. There is still a certain amount of subjectivity because the images are clearly coming from her mind, thanks to Olivier's often interesting camera and lighting tricks, but still seems to bleed some of the ambiguity out of it. Olivier's melancholy performance follows the text beat for beat, but by accentuating gestures over words, he brings some of the oddness into focus. In particular, the shaking of Ophelia's arm and of his own head that make you believe his madness rather than any planned cruelty. Hamlet is such an ambiguous text, however, that we might still infer that causing Ophelia harm on purpose causes those physical symptoms. Perhaps Hamlet goes mad because he's forced to act against those he loves, lover and mother, and so feigned madness becomes real. As for Ophelia, she's far from frightened by these events. Instead of the rush to see her father, we have a quiet internal monologue. After Hamlet does a number on her, she simply sits down and resumes her sewing. Now, obviously, she'll go to her father later because he talks to the king and queen about it in the next scene. And the implication may be that the voiceover we hear is taken from that unseen meeting. As we don't hear Polonius's reactions, we can't confirm that. She may have downplayed some elements or emphasized others. In any case, Polonius has been removed from scene one, eliminating much from his character. All this is not to say Jean Simmons doesn't give an intriguing performance here. Her Ophelia is, as I've mentioned before, a childlike dreamer. Instead of panic, she instead gives us bemused reflection as she attempts to make sense of what just happened.
And with his head over his shoulder turned, he seemed to find his way without his eyes. For out of doors he went without their help. And to the last, bended their light on me.
She peruses her own face, reenacting Hamlet's touch and smiling wistfully. The smile drops, perhaps an inner realization that her father must know of it. A natural assumption as we cut to the next scene at that point. On a personal note, I can't say I'm a fan of Olivier's melancholy Hamlet, but I am a fan of Simmons' naive Ophelia. She brings something entirely different to that role. Sadly, the BBC television production's version of the story shows off the flaws in both the casting of Ophelia and the format. While from the distance afforded by the stage, I think Lala Ward's performance would be acceptable. But even a medium shot shows her tears to be absent in all but her voice. We're too close for such a performance. We might well believe that Ophelia is faking it, just as Hamlet is, except that Jacoby's Hamlet is well and truly mad, as he'll realize himself later, and Ophelia is meant to be sincerely distraught. But as I say, from a distance, Ward's performance is adequate. There's a fun moment when she's surprised by Rinaldo's exit and catches herself in time to quickly curtsy. Polonius is kind to her, even when he makes the accusation. His fatherly love is evident. Even when the staging doesn't inspire much, I do try and pick up on a line I haven't examined before. And in this case, and perhaps because Ophelia herself has a fantastic hat, that line is, "No hat upon his head." I just realized that most, if not all, Hamlets, I've seen anyway, feature a hatless Hamlet from start to finish. Could we infer that Shakespeare staged it differently? Hamlet might have started with a hat, like those of other courtly characters, and signified his madness by taking it off and letting his hair flow wildly. Lost his hat, lost his head. Not surprisingly, Zeffirelli chooses to show the scene rather than hear talk about it. Though the director often butchers the original text, I do admire how efficient he is with the source material. Here, the scene starts with Ophelia sewing in her closet, singing the Valentine song pulled from her madness scene. In one fell swoop, Zeffirelli sets up this character trait so that it makes complete sense when it manifests itself during her madness, and evokes a romantic mood for her and the audience that is ironic in a different way than it is in its proper place. This Ophelia is a naive slip of a girl who smiles when she sees Hamlet in her chambers, but at the same time backs away, awkward, and perhaps a little afraid. It's obvious from this that she hasn't really been alone in a room with a man before. This is an as-yet chaste relationship. And in Act 1, Scene 3, we saw how Polonius and Laertes put the idea of her and Hamlet in her head. Bonham Carter played the moment as if she hadn't even considered it before. Is this the Maidenhead-stealing moment that they warned her about? And does a part of her want to defy that warning? Of course, it's not that moment. Scene 3 is echoed here by having Polonius spy on them, just as Hamlet spied on Scene 3. On a purely structural level, doing this means we don't have to then have a scene where Ophelia tells her father everything. Redundancy aside, it may also mean that Ophelia would never have told her father. The letters given her in secrecy now take the bent of having been taken without her consent. Zeffirelli's Ophelia is essentially a powerless creature who never becomes an agent of her own destiny, even fleetingly, as she usually does in Act 2, Scene 1. She makes no choice here. But what of Hamlet? Does he know in this moment that Polonius is listening? Is he therefore putting on a show? It doesn't look like it, though the interpretation is not impossible. He comes near her, he grabs her arm, which is shocking to her. We fear violence. He smells her like an animal would. Clearly Hamlet has lost his grip, and we can assume he's not being cruel on purpose, knowing he's being seen. But is he symbolically smelling her father's manipulations on her like an animal? His instincts tell him it's not safe, and he finds he cannot speak any words, lest he be compromised. He wants to tell her everything, but can't bear to let his secret out to someone who may spill the beans. It's a very effective performance from Gibson. He lets out this piteous sigh, and we see it as cold breath. And then he goes hard. Having let out his emotion, he walks out, staring at her, but colder, breaking that bond in his mind. Poor Ophelia is left standing there, unconsoled, as Polonius runs off to tell the king. Though we're missing the first part of scene one, Polonius's darkness is established in this other way. We can question his priorities and his status as a seemingly kindly old man. Hamlet 2000 continues to play with the drama's structure in this section, while also focusing on visuals rather than text. Act 2 thus begins in Hamlet's apartment, where Buddhist guru Thich Nhat Hanh is being interviewed on the television.
We have the word to be, but what I propose is the word to interbe, interbe. Because it's not possible to be alone, to be by yourself. You need other people in order to be. You need other beings in order to be. Not only you need father, mother, but also uncle.
His text is not Shakespeare's, obviously, but it still informs it. And as Hamlet absorbs this media, it informs his own character, and in particular, the to be or not to be speech. Thich Nhat Hanh speaks about being and how you must work to be, or rather work at aiming to be. He says it's not possible to be alone in this world and that you need other people in order to be. Your parents, obviously, but also society and nature. It's actually impossible to be alone, but to be, you must aim to be. The implication is that you must embrace others and the world in order to truly exist. And this contrasts with Hamlet's self-imposed isolation, so that when later he asks that famous question, it also implies another, to embrace others or cut myself off from them. There is death, and there is the death-like state of being forgotten, being apart. In the modern world of the film, where characters are motivated by an individualism perhaps not as valued in Elizabethan times, being forgotten is just as ignoble an end, and more tragic for Hamlet and Ophelia in particular, being artists. It gives new dimension to Hamlet's distress at his father having been forgotten. The scene gives impetus for Hamlet to go and see Ophelia so that he may share himself and be, though it thematically culminates later in the line, "Now I am alone." Hamlet's existential struggle is to subsume himself into his role of avenger, even though his personality is too great to be smothered. But back to the scene. While Thich Nhat Hanh speaks on the television, Hamlet is also holding a small video player, where he watches one of his short films. It is of Ophelia hiding her face with a book jacket, and there's an old man's face on that cover. I mean, can she ever be separated from her father? Is confiding in her tantamount to confessing to him? And the book's title is perhaps too on the nose. It's called Living, Dying. Okay. Hamlet is surrounded by media, some of it of his own devising, yes, and it helps craft his way of thinking. Would this Hamlet ask himself to be or not to be if an Asian guru hadn't planted the idea in his head? Does he link the speech to his situation if that guru does not mention father and mother among his examples? Does he link the concept of suicide if he's not simultaneously looking at that book jacket? And does he go see Ophelia if those two pieces of media are not played one against the other? Hamlet 2000 presents a character whose thoughts may not be his own, or at least whose environment pushes him towards certain resolutions. In the past, we might have called this destiny. Today, psychology seems a clearer motivator of human affairs. Hamlet receives messages or prods, not from some divine or wicked agency, but from the media that surrounds him, and to which he's sensitive. Wherever the impetus comes from, Hamlet is next seen in a diner attempting to write poetry for Ophelia. The text is the one normally read by Polonius to the king and queen, though we do see Hamlet ripping up some of the pages, apparently finding his phrases as vile as Polonius does. The text continues in voiceover while Hamlet walks past Ophelia's building, turns around, hesitates, and finally decides to go in. Across the street from Ophelia's place is a supermarket decorated for Halloween. This gives the director an opportunity to create, or if you prefer, sustain, a funereal and supernatural atmosphere. Inside, we find Ophelia not sewing, but developing film in her darkroom. The red lighting associates Ophelia to love, pain, and blood. In the film, she initially wears a lot of red, and it becomes grayer and then black as time goes on. It's her color, and Hamlet is in her world. The scene doesn't follow Ophelia's description from the text, though it is just as silent. In this case, Hamlet gives her the poem to read, in addition to the usual clutching and sighing. That's an important choice. In the text, we don't know when Hamlet might have written that piece of poetry, but it's suggested it comes from before his breakdown. In this version, it is a product of the isolation he feels after learning of his father's murder. He cannot say the words to her, but codes them in a poem to let her know how he still feels about her. It is only Polonius's appearance at the door that interrupts the scene and Hamlet's quest for comfort. Polonius goes to his daughter rather than the reverse, an interfering parent and a child that wants none of that interference and so doesn't run to him. Perhaps Hamlet would have found an ally in Ophelia, but it's not meant to be. In the original play, Hamlet comes to this realization alone. Here, it is forced upon him. He is a weaker version of Hamlet for it. Polonius arrives with balloons for his daughter, reducing her to the status of a child, although what can we say about the balloon with a dollar on it? It is another visual flourish, and one could argue a bit too obvious, to show Polonius's ties to the Denmark corporation, his faulty priorities, and his lack of understanding of his daughter's nature. When Hamlet sees him, he kisses Ophelia one last time and flees, embarrassed. The poem drops to the ground, and Polonius grabs it and reads it. This will make a liar out of him when he tells the king and queen his daughter dutifully gave it to him. In Fodor's more experimental version, Act 1 is immediately followed by a musical montage using a triple split screen to show characters being put into motion. Perhaps that's an echo of the chess metaphor from Act 1. It resolves into a meeting between Ophelia and Hamlet where she has sought him out and he apparently rebuffs her. This is not the scene described in Act 2, Scene 1. There is obvious arguing, which has him playing the jerk and her leaving. It serves the same function, however, giving Ophelia reason to think Hamlet is acting strangely. It is a calculated move on Hamlet's part. We see him thinking when she's not looking. And the music is Marillion's The Invisible Man. The song recalls the ghost's existence, but I think the director and the actor are both telling us that Hamlet is cutting his ties to Ophelia and erasing his self to be at one with his mission of revenge. He ceases to exist as he used to, and his relationships are forfeit. The scene ends with Ophelia leaving, and Hamlet, apparently in the morgue, kisses his father's corpse on the lips. It serves as prologue to the to be or not to be speech, which we'll get to later, but that occurs here in the film. Scene 1 begins in earnest after this scene, as previously discussed. Then Ophelia enters her sister's rooms and interrupts her possible murder of Rinalda. Polonia is clearly annoyed at this, and as Rinalda and the ghost watch, Ophelia tells her story. Strangely, she delivers the whole text as written, generating a complete disconnect with the montage seen earlier. Either she is making it up, or is confused, and this Ophelia is on drugs through the entire film, so... Or there was another unseen encounter. Perhaps Hamlet tries to change his mind about casting Ophelia aside, and then didn't really manage it. Certainly, she lies or is mistaken when she says she denied Hamlet access to her, or, are we to understand, the montage scene was about her breaking up with him, and him acting like he didn't care. Could be. But Ophelia isn't exactly affrighted, even though she uses the word, and instead seems to be suffering from the more modern malady we call anxiety. She speaks quickly. She starts on a glass of wine and brushes her hair obsessively. Polonia takes up the latter task for her, turning her murder or sexual weapon into a ribbon for her hair. Unlike the Polonius of the play, Polonia is played not as foolish, but as sinister and cruel.
That have made him mad.
Oh, that's said with relish. Like it was her plan all along to split up Hamlet and Ophelia and do him harm. There is then a strange moment where Polonia seems to become aware of the ghost's presence. Shots of his eyes meeting her eyeline. Not for the first time, the ghost seems to have a corrupting influence on the characters. In the previous part of the scene, he seemed to be egging her on to murder Rinalda. Here, he changes the intent of the line, "This must be known." Polonia has the sudden realization that if the king and queen are made aware of Hamlet's madness and or the cause of that madness, it can create more mayhem. So where does the evil of the play come from? Though Polonia, like many other characters, is thoroughly corrupt, Fodor makes the ghost the agent of that evil. In the play, the ghost is indeed a catalyst for the tragedy. In this film, that idea is taken to a horrific extreme, wherein he manipulates not only Hamlet, but the other doomed characters of the play, leading them all off the cliff. In the David Tennant Hamlet, Ophelia comes running through Elsinore in a floral dress, flowers being associated with her quite closely, and finds her father. Here is where I started losing confidence in Ophelia's casting. Mariah Gale is a good actress, and her expressions, her tears, etc., are genuine. However, I have problems with her physicality. Her posture through most of the scene is awkward and stilted, and her look is so shabby as to wonder how she was ever a match for the princely Hamlet. Her deterioration is too rapid, and she looks like she might during her madness scenes. Oliver Ford Davies' Polonius continues to be highly watchable, however, when he asks, "What said he?" We suddenly understand that he doesn't just want to understand what happened, but that he doesn't trust Ophelia to understand.
What said he?
The conclusions he jumps to, based on this secondhand account, fill him with pride, and completely disconnected from his daughter, he smiles through most of the scene. He consoles her, claiming that Hamlet's breakdown is actually a good thing. It means he loves her, can't she see? Otherwise, his attitude is, oh well. There's no empathy for her there. His next step is to take her to the king, and he does so almost on automatic, like you tell a child with a bloody knee it was time to go to the medicine cabinet. And Ophelia is a child, which is why I tend to forgive her the awkwardness. However, what does that make the 30-something Hamlet, that he is still in love with such an immature girl? Of course, that's a question we may ask of almost any production. In Slings and Arrows, Ophelia is played by Kate McNabb, who in turn is played by the now ubiquitous Rachel McAdams. In the show, which continually blurs the line between the characters and the actors who play them, Kate has a relationship with Jack, who plays Hamlet. She's his tether, finding him when he runs off and bringing him back to the theater. This is a notion from the play as well. Ophelia is Hamlet's tether, one he deliberately cuts in the unseen moment before this scene. By letting her go, reluctantly but necessarily, he loses hope for the normal life she represents. But then Hamlet, at this point, has lost faith in marriage as any kind of normalcy. McAdams McNabb gives an excellent and properly affrighted performance.
Ophelia, what's the matter?
Oh, my lord, I have been so affrighted.
In the name of God.
My lord, while I was sewing in my chamber, Lord Hamlet, his doublet all embraced, no hat upon his head, his stockings fouled, unguarded, and down jiving to his ankle, pale as his shirt, his knees knocking each other.
She's good.
And with a look so piteous in purport, as if he had been lucid out of hell to speak of horror.
Oh, she's good.
The backstage characters are impressed, and Slings doles out humor in the midst of the drama by having the culture minister's husband in the audience claim the same based on her cleavage. The show often undercuts its drama with comedy and vice versa, which is a perfectly Shakespearean thing to do. If we now take a look at the two classics illustrated, starting with the original adaptation, ever keen on dispelling ambiguity, it prefaces Act 2 with a short, informative scroll. We learn that time has definitely passed, and that Hamlet is in part mad and in part faking it. North-northwest, if you need proof in the text. Artist Alex A. Bloom shows us the scene as reported by Ophelia, but his less than expressive figure work leaves the scene without much intensity. Ophelia sits through it, and though sad, she's not affrighted. A much more timid character, then, who doesn't hold the romantic detente he ordered against her father. Similarly, Polonius is incredibly calm when he decides to tell the king and queen about Hamlet's madness. This adaptation continues to be functional. In the Berkeley prestige format version, Tom Mandrake gives up a whole page to the scene and has it take place in a lush green garden, perhaps the orchard where the murder took place. Mandrake plays with contrasts a lot in his adaptation. Just before this scene, Denmark was painted as an austere, foggy Netherland. Here, it is an Eden. It may be his way of indicating that time has passed, from the bitter cold of Act 1 to the false promise of spring in Act 2. Mandrake uses the comics medium to good effect, placing both the tale and the telling next to each other on the page, and managing perhaps one of the better exits for Hamlet, truly walking without the help of his eyes. In both adaptations, Ophelia remains sitting during her visit from Hamlet, making her a passive character that things happen to. Is it a visual indictment of her role as a motor or catalyst for the action? The passivity shown here, and frankly, it's in the text too, can be used either to show that Hamlet isn't motivated by love at all, or more ironically, that Ophelia moves the action without meaning to. In some ways, she's a red herring and a diversion. She puts Polonius and the others on the wrong track vis-a-vis Hamlet's madness. Later, she interrupts Laertes' vengeance schemes, twice even, makes Hamlet lose his focus at the graveyard, and so on. Even from the audience's point of view, she is an abortive romantic subplot. Well, that ends our look at Act 2, Scene 1, Part 2. Next time, Scene 2 begins with new arrivals. And if you have thoughts on this particular episode, please head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com and leave them there. If you like our content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/fwpodcasts. Thanks for listening, and I hope you, dear listener, will return for Act 2, Scene 2, Part 1, New Arrivals.